The wildlife and its habitat cannot speak, so we must, and we will.
You're listening to the Conservation Federation of Missouri podcast. Here's Executive Director Brandon Butler.
Welcome to a special edition of Conservation Federation. Today I'm joined by Glenn Chambers, former president of the Conservation Federation, as well as MDC employee, longtime conservationist and artist, and just all-around great guy. Glenn, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I know a lot about Glenn Chambers later in life, a lot of the professional stuff. Tell me about your childhood. Where'd you grow up, and how'd you get into this outdoor lifestyle?
Okay. I grew up on a farm in Bates County near the... I was born at home on a farm near a little town of Passaic, which is between Butler and Adrian. And anyway, as a farm boy, that's all I ever knew. At that time, that was prairie chicken country. I mean, big time. And we had a lot of prairie chickens on our farm, and we didn't particularly farm for them. They were just there because we had the grassland habitat for them, and we had food plots, which we didn't call them food plots. They were failed cornfields is what they were. But they provided some forage for the birds. And at one time, we had 50, I was looking into some of Schwartz's old records for a presentation I gave up at Frank Overly's, and I was looking in the Schwartz book, and I found the data that he recorded in 19, I think it was 42, on our farm, and we had 50 prairie chicken cocks per acre. Now, we had a population. We had a lot of birds. Anyway, life rocked on, and I grew up as a farm boy, had my regular childhood pets like raccoons and crows and foxes and coyotes and you name it. I've had 26 different species of those critters in captivity during my filming career, and I've been 60 years behind the camera. But it all started on the farm where I sawed the corner off of the smokehouse door, okay? Took a pie-shaped wedge out of the corner of the four-house door, and we had raccoons and bird dogs, and we fed those dogs. People out there will remember what cracklings are. Anyway, as a farm boy, you made cracklings every year after you had butchered hogs. And the cracklings made excellent food for the raccoon hounds and for the bird dogs. But the dogs would clean up everything off of this big rock right out in front of the smokehouse door. So when I was 8 years old, I got the idea I could saw the corner off of that door, and I can get inside and close the door and take my father's box brownie camera, which was a 120, and you crank it one way and you click, you got an exposure, and you cranked it the next way and got a click, you got another exposure. So I had a real opportunity there to get close-up birds, and it wasn't anything big deal. It was, you know, what comes to a feed station is a cardinal and a blue jay and different songbirds that like to enjoy what you got to feed everything else. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And that's where I got my start with my photography at a very, very early age, and I never looked back.
So not just a love of the outdoors with you goes back to childhood, but actually the art goes back to childhood as well.
Right. You know, I can remember when I was 6 years old, I took the shotgun shell box of I'm sure it was a Winchester. Had a probably a Gordon setter or an Irish setter, or more likely an English setter. On the box, I took the box open, and I drew a picture inside the box of a female bird dog and her litter following right behind her. And that's when I was tiny. And I persisted and continued to draw and paint. And then I got a scholarship in engineering for my architectural talents. And so it's kind of been a life of pencil and paper and paint and ducks and decoys and Conservation Federation.
So you actually went to college for architectural engineering? Or
I went to, I had a two-year scholarship at Central Missouri University in engineering. That was where I started out. But luckily, within the first month, Dr. Hoxley and the outing club, he headed that up and wanted to know if I'd help them. Now this is back in the 1950s. Wanted to know if I would join their team of mapping what he called floatable streams, or the floatable streams in Missouri, which is our whitewater streams. That book has been reduced, I think, three times, reproduced. Anyway, that got me started off really into the wildlife arena. On those trips, you know, I was a farm boy. I knew about things about Coleman lanterns and things that you need on a farm to survive. And so off we went to map the rivers and the caves. We mapped the caves, too. And that was a real experience. 4 years of it, we mapped everything out there we thought we could map. And even up in the caves, we'd follow the river right up into the cave and just keep right on going. So it was a fun time. Really stabilized my career in conservation because I was a biology and chemistry major. And then after a couple of years and seeing at Warrensburg at the university there, I got the idea that there was something out there besides architecture and all that kind of stuff. So I discreetly eased the word to my advisor that I was changing over from architecture over to biology. And so I did, and Dr. Hoxley took me under his arm and took me under his wing and said, "Here's the way we're going. Pull up your boots and let's get on it." And that's what we did. So that's how I got my collegiate start into the wildlife arena.
What year did you graduate from college, and then what did you do immediately after?
Okay, I graduated in 1954. Graduated in 54 from high school, 58 from college, 60 from the University of Missouri with my master's degree, and the next day I went to work for the Conservation Department.
And what was your first job there?
First job was down at August A. Bush Wildlife Management Area in down near Welland Spring, and I managed that for a year. Our director, Larry Gale, the department at that time was really pushing, as we still are, for more opportunity for hunting and fishing, especially for youth. And that was in 1960, okay? And so Larry Gale was our director, and he said, "Glenn, going to make you an assignment on the August A. Bush Wildlife Area, which permits no firearms hunting of any kind. And he said, your goal, before I can promote you, is that you introduce youth deer hunting with archery and squirrel hunting, okay? Now, you want to remember that that area had been set aside by Mr. Bush to be a refuge. No hunting, no fishing, field trial people, yes, bird dog, you know, training, and Labrador retriever training, and national field trials. The bird dogs had it all, the bird dogs and the rabbit people. And it was an interesting transition. I caught some real fire over the whole thing. At that time, trying to think of who the gold Democrat writer was, George someone. Okay, I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, he heard about the field trialers, heard about what was going on. A new biologist with a new name, biologist, appeared on the scene. And George Carson was his name, with the Globe Democrat. And he heard about this, and the field trials all got up in his face, and they were a very, very popular part of the landscape back in those days on the Bush area. And he said, he called up Mr. Gale, and he said, I'd like to come down and have an interview with your new biologist. And I could see where that was headed, because he was supported by these folks that thought that area had only one use, and that was for field dog trialing, any description, and a little bit of fishing. So we launched into it, and the fire began to fly, and George come out with a big article in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and he says, the boy biologist has arrived at the Bush area. He said, he wrote the story about, he said, I want to come out and ride in this topless Jeep with you and see what in the world you do to make a rabbit survey. I said, that's fine. So we set up a date. Back in those days, as a biologist, we used what we called dew boards, D-E-W-B-O-A-R-D. We used dew boards to census rabbits. We'd drive along the night before, put them out on the roadsides. In the night, they would collect the dew, okay? And you could tell, make a connection between the dew that you would see on these boards and the number of rabbits you would count on the dew board route. So anyway, it was one of my first biological experiences, and George Carson didn't like it. And boy, he got up in there and he got a lot of people up in the air about it. But Larry said, I got their director. He said, you got my support. You just do what I told you. Get a deer season, archery deer season for the kids, and get a squirrel season. And so I kept working at it, taking flack, threats, all kinds of, you know what it would be like. And so I weathered that storm, and guess what? A year to date, Mr. Gale sent me a letter, and he said, Glenn, you have done a notorious job. We have both archery deer, and now we have squirrel hunting. And he said, it's time to move you to Columbia. And so he said, I have a biologist job open for you there. And so that was my second year with the department. And I was a research biologist dealing with ringnecks and all different kinds of pheasants. So that was my early beginnings as a biologist. And it was a lot of fun. I learned a lot of things. I learned a lot about managing people. I learned about dealing with obstacles and nasty threats. So, yeah, it was good for me.
Who were some of the early people you worked with?
Mike Malonsky was an area manager just before I got there. And so I managed it for a year. Then Freddie Anderson took over my place. Then Pearlie Cassidy took over his place. But we had 7,000 acres. There was plenty for all of us to do. And we got her done, yeah.
What about when you transitioned to Columbia? There's some people in that office with you?
Yeah, the transition was like overnight from Bush area to Columbia Research. So there wasn't much of a breaking in period. Bill Crawford was my new supervisor, and what a wonderful person he was to have for a supervisor. And Bill was one of those wonderful people that could see what the potential of a youngster could be. And he looked into the crystal ball, and he said, "This boy needs to be on board. Bring him on, and I'll find jobs for him to do." So I worked on the pheasants at first, and that was a fun job. But in the meantime, I was taking photographs on the side. Say, like, I was photographing a rough grouse on a log, and I would get up at 2:30 in the morning, go to Ashland, Missouri, where we were releasing grouse that we were getting in Ohio, and we made it work, and I found some drumming logs, and I set up some after everything had to be after dark. Those are the guys, because I was doing everything with electronic flash. So I found two logs that had drumming birds on them, and spent months, morning after morning, every month, every night that it didn't rain, I was down there the next morning in my blind. You say, "Well, why didn't you go after the rain?" Well, the day after a rain, a grouse looks more like a picked chicken than it does like a rough grouse.
And where were you shooting those pictures?
They were all shot down at Ashland.
Ashland.
And on the Thomas Basket area, yeah.
Yeah, John Knutson tells me about when you were his supervisor that you weren't one to sleep in.
No, sleeping in was not part of our regime. And, you know, it was real interesting. It happened that the department came out with the thing where your temporary employee could only work 8 hours. So guess what? I broke my 8-hour stance into 2 4-hour ones, and I had these two boys. That way I could work 24 hours. They could work 8. Okay. So anyway, it was a great time, a great time to be there, and it was and still is a wonderful place to work.
So earlier you mentioned Charlie, and for those that don't know who you're talking about, that's Charlie Schwartz, the famous artist.
Right.
How did your paths cross, and how did the Charlie and Glenn show come to be?
Okay, if you look in 1964, Missouri Conservationist, on the cover, it is a picture of a rough grouse drumming. Now, we're going way back. Arthur A. Allen, Cornell University, took the first picture of a drumming grouse on the log 40 years ago, before I even came on the scene. No one else had even got close, nor wanted to, nor needed to. But when I saw what a wonderful bird that was, and that we were reintroducing them, and that maybe someday they'd be a game bird in our state, I said, we ought to promote this. So we began to promote it with this picture on that 64 issue of The Conservationist, of a beautiful ruff grouse strutting on a log near Ashland, Missouri. That thing caused such a wow furor. Charlie and Libby Schwartz grabbed on to me and they said, we can see here that you got some talent, because I had lots of other pictures scattered around, deer and coyotes and foxes and whatever. So my grouse picture wasn't the only picture out there. And then they sifted through these pictures and they said, we feel you have enough talent that we can turn you loose with a movie camera, and we can be on with making the show promoting the 1/8 of 1%. And so we began on that movie. And wow, I made during my tenure with the department, I made, I think it's seven full length films. Now these aren't videos. This isn't tape. This is 16mm. We're talking about the good old days with film. So I created. Charlie just gave me assignments. He was off doing 1/8 of 1%. Libby was helping me do the editing. I was turning out film as fast as Libby could catch up and keep up with me. And we made the film design for Conservation. And that was, Charlie said, Glenn, you're going to be, you write the scripts, you do the whole thing, you do it. It's your baby, designed for Conservation. And he was all hobnobbing with the big boys, lining up money, lining up support, things like that. Libby was busy behind the lines, editing and getting the show ready. You know, a lot of times I'd have three shows going at one time, say like Design for Conservation and many of the Canada Goose Picture, Wild Forest. So it was a fun time. And you know, Bill Crawford, when Charlie and the director approached Bill about taking Glenn Chambers away from pheasant biology and putting him in the motion picture business, Bill absolutely jumped for joy. He said, I don't want to lose that good employee, but he said he'll do the job you guys want him to do. And so we made a number of films, Wild Chorus, which is about the Canada Geese, Return of the Wild Turkey, was my very first film I ever made. And then we did the Design for Conservation. I did 7 or 8 others after that, Otters and Back to the Wild. And
so if you've ever seen the picture around the Department of Conservation of the geese flying next to the bluff over the river, that's one of your shots. Yeah. And it looks like the geese are way up high. Right. But tell some of the cinematic magic behind getting that shot.
Well, that shot required way over a year of setup and preparation. Because when I worked for Ducks Unlimited, I was on the Arctic and I watched these Canada geese. And then later, Schwartz and I went up there and I was watching the behavior of these Canada geese, and I said, wow, Glenn, if you could ever capture those birds in flight and that kind of stuff, that it would be phenomenal. So at that time, I did work for Ducks Unlimited. And so I got permission to fly 6 eggs from Cook County, Illinois, which is right downtown. And they were giant Canada geese. I got permission to get 6 eggs flown here and permission to incubate them in my father-in-law's incubator in Kirksville and consequently imprint these baby geese. And that was a real project, imprint them. And I also had to round up a crew that could be on site daily to help with this project. So we hatched the baby geese, we imprinted them to four-wheeler, imprinted them to the outboard motor boats. And it was Kim Graham and his wife, Connie, and their two kids, Jill and Scott. That was our photographic entourage when we moved across the country with the geese. With the geese in tow and a little trailer that I had built, and the geese loved it. They loved to go for the rides in the trailer. They loved to go for the rides in the boat up and down the Missouri River. We went to Fountain Grove and thrilled the kids up there one day with a show of flight of Canada geese. And it turned out to be a one-of-a-kind deal because it eventually led to 4 television Emmys. And so it was a worthwhile venture, although it was labor-intensive and took a whole year to do it, but it was worth it.
Yeah, those shots are iconic. They're going to live forever.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
They do.
So, you know, aside from being a goose father, you also are an otter father.
Yeah, right. The otter thing came along. You know, my arrangement was for the Fish and Wildlife Service that when I was finished with them, and the arrangement was that they would go back into the wild. And so we just left them there on the pond at Kim Graham's house and fed them corn around the edge of the lake. Well, the first thing you know the rest of the story, the corporate geese didn't find them long to hear a call flock and say, these guys must be eaten. And so they came in, and we let the wild geese intermix with the tame geese. And that was a zoo parade, I'll tell you for sure. The tame geese thought they were people. The wild geese knew they were geese. So the goofy tame geese would get out on the pond. Here had come the wild geese, corporate geese from downtown Columbia, coming out to eat their fare. And so it turned out beautifully because at first they intermingled. The very first time all that flock of wild geese showed up, that whole bunch, those 6 imprinted geese would hit it for the basement door because they didn't know what those things were. Those things liked them, but they didn't like them. And so those geese had run from the pond up to the vestibule on the back porch and peck on the window to get in, let us out of the way of these monsters. And finally, we just let them gradually go back and forth. And they acclimated back into the wild. And it was quite a deal. In fact, one of them imprinted on the Graham property. I think one went to a tub, but I think I know another one set up a nest between the foundation of the house and the air conditioning unit, which is 4 feet away. Okay. She set up for like 4 or 5 years in there, raised about 10 or 11 babies. out of there. And she and those babies are still imprinted. They go right to that, air conditioner to have their babies. Huh. So it's pretty funny.
But over time, they eventually merged into the wild geese. And
Yep. The whole flock. They come back every spring now, set up housekeeping, go through the whole ritual. So the Grahams are stuck with geese from now on.
Yep. Oh, that's a pretty cool story. So how did the otters come to be?
The otters came to be, make sure I get all this right.
Because I don't know how many people have come up to me and said, I know Glenn Chambers, he brought otters to my school.
Yeah, I did.
You're famous across the state.
Right, Jeannie and I both, hours and hours and thousands of miles. 800,000 miles.
Within the borders of Missouri?
No, we worked four states to work to start with. Then we culled it down. We had to calm it down. So we calmed it down to just the Missouri borders. And we went to almost every school in the state. And those kids were absolutely ecstatic when you come into school with something they'd never seen or touched. And it was a great thing. We did that for 13 years. Then the otters got tired, and Jeannie began to falter, and I got really tired. And the otter boys that we had working, John McRoberts, and I had a number of them through the years. We all, after that many years of it, said, let's fold the tent. And so we folded the tent on the otter show. We did the very first one at Runge, did the very last one at Runge.
But and the purpose was to kind of re-educate people about otters.
The purpose of all this rhetoric and hauling otters was to educate the people out there about what the true river otters were all about. There was so much misinformation at the time on otters and what they were going to do and what they weren't going to do. And our mission was to educate people, educate kids, educate adults. The adults needed it just as much as the kids. So we'd go to county fairs. I mean, we went places. We went to one county seat where the otter issue was the hottest of all of them. And
where was that?
That was at Houston, Missouri. And we had our otter show at the fairgrounds. And so I talked to a protection section, and I said, guys, this could be a hot one. Because here's where all of this concern popped up from, and Debo McKinney was one of the people that was ramrodding the getting rid of the otters. I understood exactly where he came from. But, you know, we went to that program. When we pulled in to the fairgrounds, the parking lot was absolutely full of people. And so I'd talk to the conservation agents, and I said, this is going to be a hot issue down here. Why don't you guys have some firearms, some sidearms ready? It didn't boil down to that, but it was a hot, hot discussion. And, of course, you had it from both sides. People were saying, why did you release them? Whether they're the worst thing that you would ever do to Missouri. And we had other people on the other side said those are the most beautiful creature. We understand why you like them. We like them, too. We like to have them in our streams. And so you had this back and forth. And it was condemned. It still goes on today. But our otter complaints have dropped off way, way off.
And was the early concern just that they would decimate fish populations?
Right. That was it. That was the early concerns of the people that were against the otters.
But yep. Somehow otters and fish have coincided since.
Yep, right. It has been a long, hard, nasty story. And I don't have time to sit here and tell you the whole thing of how all of that got started. When I told the director of the conservation department, after about the second program I had, I said, you better get ready because this thing is going to get out of control quick. So we met with all the division chiefs, and I told them, I said, here's what I see ahead. I see nothing but trouble if we don't try to head this thing off as we speak. And he said, what are you proposing? I said, an otter advisory council. I said, this is a group of people, and they will all be on the same page on their side of the fence, and they can get together and they can hash out what they feel are their major differences. So Dan Witter was our go-between, and he coordinated the whole thing. And we did it for about 3 or 4 years, and it made an impact. Some of the folks in the deep Ozarks said, forget it, the conservation department, they did it on purpose, they can't retract it now, so the otters are here. And they are, they're here to stay. I mean,
what does the otter population in Missouri look like today?
I'd say just under 8,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
All the way north to south, east to west?
Yeah, 8,000 wide. At one time, when we were right in the middle of the otter programs, that's when Dave Hamilton was a fur bearer biologist, and he passed away. One time we felt we had just over 13,000 otters in the state. Then we divided the state into regions, six regions, and we put a quota per region. If you live in the Kansas City arena, one otter. If you lived in the Ozarks, especially down around Houston, Texas County, the limit was wide open. Well, back then, for those folks in that quadrant, about the same time, otter pelts went out of sight. They're $125 a head. People moved for $125 otter. People were moving from Trenton, Missouri, down to wherever it was that the biggest complaint was coming from.
To be professional otter trappers.
Yep, be professional otter trappers. Well, then the big bang hit. The Chinese used these little fur hats and their military uniform, okay? And that's where our Missouri otters were going. We're going to China to make these head wraps. Well, when the Chinese decided to do away with the Chinese fur cap, that took care of the otter business. And the next year, the otter price per pelt dropped to 25 for a poor one to 35 or 40. So the market fell out of it. It may have not been in that proportion, but it was drastic. It was drastic enough that the people quit going from North Missouri to South Missouri to catch an otter.
So you've had an incredible professional career. I mean, through the biology side of it, land management, the arts, these animals that you parented. But you've also been an incredible philanthropist and involved in a lot of organizations. Conservation Federation is just one of them. I know the Boy Scouts have been real near and dear to your heart. Ducks Unlimited as both an employee and a volunteer. Right. Talk a little bit about your time in nonprofits and all the things you've done and have given of yourself over time.
You know what? One thing that gets you really, really nonprofits interested in you, if you are willing to and able to create items they can sell at their auctions and their silent auctions and their voice auctions, you've got a heel down on you. Because you've got a bullseye on your back for every one of them, and that's fine. I have given literally thousands and thousands of dollars, and I don't collect for them. I don't ask money for them, but it's a lot of fun to do it. So, yeah, all those organizations, DU, the Prairie Foundation, Grouse, when they were going, anyway, there are numerous. Federation, I've been gracious to get a lot of things to them.
We are getting ready to mail out our Glenn Chambers note cards.
Okay.
Ladies have been stuffing them, and we're excited to get those out. So
I'm anxious to see them.
They look good. They look great. You. Dave Graber helped us with some of the wording on the back, so keep passing it on.
Okay.
But the Boy Scouts, so you won the Hornaday Award.
Right.
Now, I don't know much about that. I know you're only the 40th person to win this.
Right.
You're in the same boat as Theodore Roosevelt and Aldo Leopold.
Yeah.
Tell us about your work with the Boy Scouts and how that all wound up with you being honored with this award.
I was never a Boy Scout. I grew up on a farm. You don't have time to be a Boy Scout when you're a farm boy. It's get home from school, feed the livestock, get ready for bed, go to bed. Next morning at 7 o'clock, catch a bus. You're on there almost. You're gone all the daylight hours. And then you're back, same old, same old. But when our first son was 6 years old, I enrolled him in the Boy Scout division, and I was Cub Master right over here at Russell School for 7 years. Then I was Scout, followed that right along with him, and then I was Scout Master for another 7 years. And so then they got the idea of promoting people up. And so I was held several positions. I'm presently on the council, and that's high as I'm going. And they appreciate the work. I've donated a lot of work for them. And consequently, this Hornaday Award came about through one of my fraternity brothers that's a scout in Cleveland, Ohio. He was a Boy Scout here then. He was a scout leader here then. And he came up with the bright idea after doing some research that someone with a resume like mine deserved to have a shot at the best award the Boy Scouts give for conservation. And so they put together a resume, they sent her in, and I got the big old beautiful plaque around here somewhere. It's the William T. Hornaday Award, awarded to only 40 adult counters in, I was going to say, 60 years. Leo, let's see, Teddy Roosevelt got number one. Aldo Leopold, these are medallions, gold medallions. And I got lucky and got number 3 out of 40.
That's amazing. We don't have time to go through all of your awards. All of your awards. But we should talk about your Master Conservationist Award, because that's a really big deal as well. And you were just awarded that. Real honored to see that award given to you at the CFM convention, and that was a wonderful night. About 500 of your closest friends there to honor you.
Oh, yeah. That was a great, great evening. The Hornady Award has been a biggie. That one was a biggie. I'd put those at the top. Although I've got a lot of other really, really honorable awards, those two kind of stand out in my mind. If I was going to say, which two of all these accolades you got hanging here, which two of these are you the most proudest of? And I'd grab that Hornady Award, and I'd grab that award I just received at the CFM convention.
And the Master Conservationist.
Master Conservationist, yep. Yeah, because that was a biggie, man. It was, and what a turnout they had for it. You guys put yourself out big time.
It wasn't hard to convince people to come see you.
But wow, they did a wonderful job because they showed up.
Talk about your involvement in CFM. Okay. I mean, I know you became president and helped lead us through the foundation of CLC, but the early years, how'd you get involved and what was it like back then?
Back then it was Ed Stegner and Ann Kutcher. So I had known Ed through just association with people that belonged to CFM. And so I was a good friend of Ed. We duck hunted and did some quail hunting together. So he said, Glenn, he said, there's a place for you in our organization. And I said, Ed, I said, I've got a lot of things going on. What are you talking about? So he kind of laid out the program of the annual meetings and the quarterly meetings and whatever. And I said, yeah, let me think about it. Well, about that time, Ann got involved and she put the crusher on me. She said, don't be trying to back out. She said, we need you. And so I said I'd help. And I went through the ranks from member to life member. And then I was on the Waterfowl Resource Committee and have been on it since we started it. And, it's a vital part of our conservation program in Missouri. I mean, that's our voice for you folks out there listening, okay? And we appreciate if you would help us, join us, support us in any way you can. So it's a wonderful organization. It's a voice of our outdoors through us, the people.
Very citizen-based.
Yeah, right, yep.
Yeah, it's amazing when I travel around the country, and we have some really good sister organizations and states, but not too many as strong as the Conservation Federation.
Yeah.
Well, we're running up on an hour.
We are? Yeah,
we are. It goes quick, doesn't it?
It does.
So what are just a few great memories you want to share about time spent outdoors?
When I start thinking about time that I've spent outdoors, it's time that I've spent in the photography blind in locations from above the Arctic Circle to Guatemala. And that's a lot of miles, and there are a lot of critters in between. But, the polar bears, the Alaskan brown bears, all of the species that I've photographed while I was in those places, then go on down to Guatemala, photograph the turkey down there. That was a highlight. The oscillated turkey, which you have shot one.
I've got one hanging on the wall.
Yeah.
It's the greatest hunt of my life.
Yeah. All of those safaris bundled make a lifetime of really joy for me. And to pick out one that I really got in depth in and really love is the prairie chickens in the Kansas sand hills for years. Now, I didn't go this year, but for years I've been out there photographing prairie chicken booming, and that's one of my favorites. but I have a lot of favorites.
Those prairie chickens take you all the way back to being a boy in the smokehouse.
They do take me all the way back there. I got attached to those little prairie chickens. We would see them run around out there in the front yard. And, wow.
Well, what's your hope for the future of conservation in Missouri?
You know, I think we have a bright future for conservation. I think we have youth that are interested in conservation. I think we need to put more emphasis on the youth because that's where it is. You know, that's what everybody says. That's where it is. Well, they're right. That's where it is. And anything that's youth-centered in our position, see, I'm 81 years old. I've been 60 years behind the camera doing one thing, and that's taking pictures. You've got to be dedicated, I'd say. But anyway, there's room for kids out there to do what I have done. If they want to apply themselves and pick up their bootstraps and said, like Charlie Schwartz told me, he said, pull up your hip bootstraps, we're heading this way. And that's what I did. And, been a great, great life. Great time.
Yeah. Well, on behalf of the Federation and so many of your friends that are listening to this, I just want you to know how much we appreciate you and how much we really love you. And thanks a lot for doing this today.
And no problem. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. This is a tenth of what's left. Okay, we've got 10 more of these.
All right, Glenn, thanks a lot.
Thank you.